Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Keep an eye on the crude oil market.
Mark Gold is Managing Director, StoneX Financial's FCM division.
You know, what is going to happen there, nobody knows. But if we make new highs in the crude oil, something is popping there. That should be good for the grain markets, in my opinion. I think the bean oil will go through the roof. We'll find some place to get rid of the meal. Corn, wheat, all should consider, could go considerably higher out here. You know, God forbid there's anything nuclear out there. We saw what happened in Chernobyl, I think it was in 1986. The prices spiked. Yeah, it was only for 2 or 3 days. But look at what they did in those 2 or 3 days, and then they backed off again. So we have to be very careful about what's happening with that war scenario, and watching crude oil prices, I think, is kind of key to that.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
USDA out with two big reports on Friday, the U.S. cattle on feed report and cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. And this looks at feedlots with a capacity of 1,000 or more head, 11.4 million as of June 1st. That inventory 1% below June of 2024. Now, expectations by the trade was 99%, and USDA hits that right on the head. What about placements? The trade was expecting, on average, 94.9%. USDA says placements in feedlots, actually, 92%, 1.89 million head. Net placements, 1.82 million head during May. Placements of cattle and calves weighing less than 600 pounds, 335,000 head. For the six weights, 275,000 head. Seven weights, 450,000 head. Eight weights, 516,000 head. Nine weights, 230,000 head. And those weighing 1,000 pounds or more, 80,000 head. Now, marketing's trade was expecting, on average, 90.3%. And USDA hits that number, 90%. On marketing's of fed cattle during the month of May, 1.76 million head. The other disappearance number, according to USDA's report on Friday, 62,000 head during May, unchanged from the same month in 2024. USDA also out with their May milk production update. And for the 24 major states during the month of May, 19.1 billion pounds, up 1.7% from May of 2024. April revised production, 18.6 billion pounds, up 1.7% from April of 2024. Now, that April revision represented an increase of 17 million pounds from the previous month's preliminary production estimate. Production per cow in the 24 major states, 2,125 pounds for May, 7 pounds above May of 2024. And when it comes to production per cow, California remains number one, Wisconsin number two, Texas number three. Number of milk cows on farms in the 24 major states, 9 million head, 118,000 head more than May of 2024, and a 6,000 head increase month over month. May milk production in the U.S. up 1.6%. Milk production in the U.S. during the month of May, 19.9 billion pounds, up 1.6% from the same time last year. Production per cow in the U.S. averaging 2,110 pounds for the month of May, 7 pounds above May of 2024. And again, the number of milk cows on farms in the U.S., 9.45 million head, 114,000 more than May of 2024, 5,000 head more than April of 2025. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Our monetary policy actions are guided by our dual mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people. At today's meeting, the committee decided to maintain the target range for the federal funds rate at 4.25% to 4.5%, and to continue reducing the size of our balance sheet.
Jerome Powell is chairman of the Federal Reserve following 2 days of meetings for the FOMC.
Changes to trade, immigration, fiscal, and regulatory policies continue to evolve, and their effects on the economy remain uncertain. The effects of tariffs will depend, among other things, on their ultimate level. Expectations of that level, and thus of the related economic effects, reached a peak in April and have since declined. Even so, increases in tariffs this year are likely to push up prices and weigh on economic activity. The effects on inflation could be short-lived, reflecting a one-time shift in the price level. It's also possible that the inflationary effects could instead be more persistent. Avoiding that outcome will depend on the size of the tariff effects, on how long it takes for them to pass through fully into prices, and ultimately on keeping longer-term inflation expectations well anchored. Our obligation is to keep longer-term inflation expectations well anchored and to prevent a one-time increase in the price level from becoming an ongoing inflation problem. As we act to meet that obligation, we will balance our maximum employment and price stability mandates, keeping in mind that without price stability, we cannot achieve the long periods of strong labor market conditions that benefit all Americans. We may find ourselves in the challenging scenario in which our dual mandate goals are in tension. If that were to occur, we would consider how far the economy is from each goal and the potentially different time horizons over which those respective gaps would be anticipated to close. For the time being, we are well positioned to wait to learn more about the likely course of the economy before considering any adjustments to our policy stance. In our SEP, FOMC participants wrote down their individual assessments of an appropriate path for the federal funds rate based on what each participant judges to be the most likely scenario going forward. The median projection projects participant projects that the appropriate level of the federal funds rate will be 3.9% at the end of this year, the same as projected in March. The median projection declines to 3.6% at the end of next year and to 3.4% at the end of 2027, a little higher than the March projection. These individual forecasts are always subject to uncertainty, and as I've noted, uncertainty is unusually elevated. And, of course, these projections are not a committee plan or decision. At this meeting, the committee continued its discussions as part of our 5-year review of our monetary policy framework. We focused on issues related to assessing the risks and uncertainties that are relevant for monetary policy and the potential implications for policy strategy and communications. Our review includes outreach and public events involving a wide range of parties, including Fed Listens events around the country, and a research conference that we held last month. We are open to new ideas and critical feedback, and we will take on board lessons of the last 5 years in determining our findings. We intend to wrap up any modifications to our statement on longer-run goals and monetary policy strategy by late summer. After that, we will consider enhancements to our suite of communications tools, including the SEP. The Fed has been assigned 2 goals for monetary policy, maximum employment and stable prices. We remain committed to supporting maximum employment, bringing inflation sustainably to our 2% goal, and keeping longer-term inflation expectations well anchored. Our success in delivering on these goals matters to all Americans. We understand that our actions affect communities, families, and businesses across the country. Everything we do is in service to our public mission, and we at the Fed will do everything we can to achieve our maximum employment and price stability goals.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, some are highlights, some are lowlights.
Mark Gold has been a trader for over 50 years. He serves as managing director of StoneX Financial's FCM division. What are highlights and lowlights?
I would say the biggest lowlight was when President Carter embargoed the Russians in 1979. It killed our wheat market. We've never fully recovered, though we've seen, you know, wheat at, you know, $12 in Chicago and higher in Minneapolis, but we haven't been able to see sustained growth. And the Russians, you know, took that as a sign that the U.S. isn't going to be a consistent supplier and developed their own supplies. And that has hurt our wheat market over the last 50 years. You know, unless we have some kind of weather market or, you know, there's a real demand issue somewhere, you know, it's hard for wheat to sustain these rallies out here. Well, that was one of the lowlights. I would say some of the highlights were in the 80s. We had the drought in 1980, 83, and 88. I've been kind of a bull. I was on the floor. I was on the trading floor as a member starting in 1977. So I saw the Baruzzi deal with the grains and the July-November bean spread going to $3 over. As a bull, you know, those were probably three of my best years in the business. I just love a big bull market. So those were certainly highlights. Again, another low light is when the exchange went public. You know, I understand the reasoning for it. I didn't own my seat. I sold my seat in 1995. I bought it in 1977, and I made, one heck of a nice profit on that. But I don't know that I would have voted to turn it public. I think, you know, these algorithm traders and the extent of which the funds are trading now and the high-frequency traders, they've taken a lot of the fundamental reasoning out of this market. They've got the money and the power and the speed of the computers, and I just personally don't think it's great for the market. But I think what we have to keep in mind is that the markets are still subject to supply and demand. And I can gripe about the algo traders and high-frequency traders and the funds, but they can't do what they do unless the fundamentals basically agree with it. Now, they get carried away, you know, to the long side. They get carried away to the short side. And I think, you know, for a lot of your listeners out there, you know, how do you trade this thing? Well, first of all, you really, if you're a farmer out there, don't speculate. You make your money farming. You don't make your money speculating. If you're such a good speculator, you don't need to be farming. And we know that only 7% of outside speculators can beat the pros in Chicago. So I think it's a kind of a fool's game to try. But the supply and demand will control these markets in the long run. In the short run, the funds and the algos can certainly move their weight around. I don't think that's good. I'm an old school guy. You know, I'm 71, and, you know, I prefer the old style of doing things. Maybe it wasn't the fastest. Maybe, you know, you had to wait for your fills, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, but it got better over time. And I just, you know, I prefer the old ways, but that's just, you know, being an old codger. You know, if I was 25 years old, I'd want to know everything I could about computers and AI and the rest of it out here.
Wealth of knowledge after 50 years of trading. Mark Gold with StoneX. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's very, very hard to say when that will happen. We know that the time will come. It could come quickly. It could not come quickly.
It's the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, talking about tariffs.
As long as the economy is solid, though, as long as we're seeing the kind of labor market that we have and reasonably decent growth and inflation moving down, we feel like the right thing to do is to be where we are, where our policy stance is, and just learn more. And in particular, we feel like we're going to learn a great deal more over the summer on tariffs. We hadn't expected them to show up much by now, and they haven't. And we will see whether to the extent to which they do over coming months. And I think that's going to inform our thinking, for one thing. In addition, we'll see how the labor market progresses. So at some point, it will become clear. I can't tell you exactly when that will be. And, you know, meanwhile, we'll be watching the labor market very carefully for signs of weakness and strength, and tariffs for signs of what's going to happen there. And, of course, there are many developments ahead. You know, even in the near term, developments are expected on tariffs. So I think we don't yet know with any confidence where they will settle out. We have an estimate, and it's a pretty, I think all estimates are now pretty close together, but it's again, highly uncertain.
Following 2 days of FOMC meetings last week, he also addressed inflation.
We've had 3 months of favorable inflation readings since the high readings of January and February, and that's, of course, highly welcome news. Part of that just is that services, core services, both housing services and non-housing services, have really been grinding down toward levels that are consistent with 2% inflation. So that's the good news. We've had goods inflation just moving up a bit, and of course we expect, as you point out, we do expect to see more of that over the course of the summer. It takes some time for tariffs to work their way through the chain of distribution to the end consumer. A good example of that would be goods being sold at retailers today may have been imported several months ago before tariffs were imposed. So we're beginning to see some effects, and we do expect to see more of them over coming months. We do also see price increases in some of the relevant categories, like personal computers and audiovisual equipment and things like that, that are attributable to tariff increases. In addition, we look at surveys of businesses, and there are many of those, and you do see a range of things, but many companies do expect to put all or some or all of the effect of tariffs through to the next person in the chain, and ultimately to the consumer. Today, the amount of the amount of the tariff effects, the size of the tariff effects, their duration and the time it will take are all highly uncertain. So that is why we think the appropriate thing to do is to hold where we are as we learn more. And we think our policy stance is in a good place where we're well positioned to react to incoming developments. So if you look at the forecast, you will see that people do generally expect inflation to move up and then to come back down. But we can't just assume that. Of course, we don't know that. And, our job is to make sure, one of our jobs is to make sure that a one-time increase in inflation doesn't turn into an inflation problem. And that, again, that will depend on the size of the effects, how long it takes for them to come in, and ultimately on keeping inflation expectations anchored.
From inflation to the new world screwworm, Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins.
We are fighting the screwworm domestically, announcing plans for a sterile fly dispersal facility at Moore Air Base in Hidalgo County. We have the facilities in Panama. We're funding another facility south of the border. What this will allow us to do is to fly the larva up from the facility in Panama and the other facility here to South Texas, here in Hidalgo County, to finish off so that the sterile flies are ready to go, load them in the planes, and then get them across the border.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
According to AFT research, in the first 15 years of this century, we've lost 2,000 acres a day. That means 11 million acres of farmland were paved over, built up, or converted to uses that otherwise threaten agriculture.
Testifying earlier this month in front of a Senate Ag Subcommittee, Tim Fink, Policy Director, American Farmland Trust.
AFT research projects that without further policy intervention, we're likely to lose 18 million more acres of agriculture to development by 2040. And many communities are already seeing this prediction being outpaced. Continued conversion of this finite resource threatens our food security, our national security, and the viability of our agricultural sector. Put simply, no farms, no food. It is also pushing production in the marginal lands and slamming the doors shut to the next generation. They offer landowners a vital option, a way to extract equity from their land without selling it for development, which is often the only option for a land-rich, cash-poor farmer when they reach retirement or face family or business expenses. Landowner easement remains in private ownership and on the tax rolls, and it can be transferred to a new owner at any time with the easement conditions running with the land. Such easements benefit farmers, the farm, the community, and society as a whole. Here are four ways. First, easements support reinvestment in agriculture. Research shows that farmers and ranchers use easement proceeds to improve or diversify their operations, purchase new equipment, land, infrastructure. Second, easements support the transfer of agricultural land. The sale of an easement can help finance retirement without a farmer needing to give up their most cherished asset. For aspiring farmers, protected land is more affordable. In fact, it may be the only land they can afford. Third, easements spur additional conservation. A recent survey found that the majority of landowners with easements have NRCS conservation plans, and over 75% have adopted at least three conservation practices. This is because of something we refer to as permanent syndrome. Farmers are more likely to make these long-term investments if they know that the land is going to remain in agriculture long enough for those investments to bear fruit. Fourth, easements benefit rural communities and economies. A 2022 Montana study found that between 2014 and 2021, every ASIP dollar spent yielded nearly twice that amount in economic activity. These investments also supported over 1,000 local jobs. It is for these reasons that 30 states and over 100 local governments invest in easement programs. That list now includes the state of Tennessee. AFT was also pleased to see Secretary Rollins point to the benefits of ASIP Bail as part of the administration's Farmer First agenda. We are grateful to this committee, and especially to Chairman Thompson, for championing important easement reforms in the Farm, Food, and National Security Act of 2024. I will highlight just a few. First, The bill would increase long-term funding for conservation programs by transferring unspent IRA conservation dollars into the Farm Bill, a measure also included in the recent reconciliation package. This is AFT's top Farm Bill priority, since it will enable more farmers to protect their land and implement the very practices they need to build more profitable operations for decades to come. Second, the bill would increase ASIP's general federal match and offer a lower match option for program partners. The increase in the match would enable more participation in the program in parts of the country where there are no matching funding to be found. The lower match option would provide an alternative for public programs that have had trouble reconciling their program rules with that of USDA. Third, the bill would streamline ASIP by empowering experienced certified entities to play a larger role. Certified entities help to reduce easement closing times and could do more to improve the experience for landowners. A greater focus on certification can reduce both costs and administrative burdens for USDA. And fourth, the bill eliminates ASIP AIL's adjusted gross income eligibility requirement. This change recognizes that an easement payment is different than a conservation cost share payment. This will also help reduce closing times and ensure that the program is focused on the lands most vital to conservation.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, you and I have been watching the ratio of wheat, cash wheat prices to cash corn prices in Garden City area, because if we're going to feed wheat anywhere, it would be there.
Kansas State grain economist Dan O'Brien following a big bump up in wheat futures.
Suddenly that ratio is at 117%. So, you know, when the wheat price jumps up, corn price stays where it's at, then it works against the profitability of feeding wheat. And that's what happened in this situation.
And on corn?
The risk in terms of corn tends to be defined by when the crop is vulnerable to high temperatures. And that's, of course, as we come out of where we're at right now in the U.S. and in Kansas, where the crop's pretty much, you know, it's been planted, it's emerging. Next vulnerable timeframes are silking, doughing, and again, moving on, denting, moving on to maturity. A lot of that happens from now. You know, you're starting into that in the last half of June on in through July. And, you know, so we're coming into that now. Suddenly we've got hot, dry temperatures forecast for about the next week or so. And, still worries about what weather forecasts are for July. As you and I have been talking about this, we've kind of wondered about where's the worry about crop conditions for corn and soybeans yet. Well, it seems like with the combination of the market being worried about tariffs on the one hand, overall in agriculture with generally up to this point, pretty good moisture, not too stressful conditions, and probably algorithm computerized trading affecting how you value risk or not, more so than it was in the past, that the market really hasn't been valuing risk going forward, as you put it in, as you look at the harvest contracts for Dease corn and November beans, the CME, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, has indices that show the amount of risk that the market's trading on, and it's 30-day rolling averages. It's a CVOL index for corn and for beans. Both of those markedly lower at this time of year than they have been in previous years. But in previous years, there's tended to come a spike, a big jump when volatility came in, and we just haven't seen anything like that so far. Well, if weather is going to drive something like that, it probably is going to happen in July for corn, in August for soybeans. So now we've got some weather conditions at play, or at least forecast to be at play, and we'll see where that goes. So, and I would say, just to clean up a few other issues, still strong U.S. corn exports. There's a pretty kind of a preliminary export report that came out on Monday. Then there's a final one that comes out typically on Thursday. It'll be out this morning instead. But again, 66 million bushels of corn shipped for the week ending the 12th. About 1.1 million bushels shipped of grain sorghum also for the week of June 12th. Soybeans are struggling more. Again, I think you've got the weight of strong South American crops coming into play. Last thing to say, you know, we've been talking about weather issues in South America for a while. Well, now their problems, what they're worried about isn't being dry, they're getting too much rain in a number of their key production areas. So that can also be at play with our heat in the next couple of weeks.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The summary from USDA's June catalog feed report from livestock analyst Michael McConnell.
Inventories are going down, but the market hasn't seen as much cattle marketed, so that's kind of kept the inventory levels from falling even further.
So looking at the numbers for the month of May.
On June 1st, there was 11.44 million head of cattle in those feedlots, which is 1% lower than a year ago. That was a result of placements during the month of May totaling 1.89 million head, which was 8% lower than a year ago.
Yet for marketings of fed cattle,
marketings came in at 1.76 million head, which was 10% lower than a year ago. Although if you account for one fewer slaughter day, it was about 6% lower in this past May versus last May.
The tighter inventories in cattle feedlots are just one component behind supportive prices for beef.
Whether it be for feeder cattle, for fed cattle, or for beef at the wholesale or retail level. So overall, the tight supplies are resulting in supportive pricing all throughout the value chain.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.